Welcome to episode 17 of Photo Geek Weekly, the show where we really dive into the rabbit hole under the hood. We take that deep dive into the world of photography from a geeky perspective, the technical stuff, the stuff that people might not be talking about otherwise. Maybe it's the industry behind the scenes. And this week, I've got somebody that I have respected for many years, both as a photographer and a photographic educator on the show with us. So welcome to Jay Patel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Don. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Finally get to meet in person.
Yes. You know, we've been in the same circles for a long time, but our paths haven't directly crossed until right now. So I think this is going to be a fun discussion. But before we get into the topics that we have to talk about today, I got to ask, what's new and exciting with you? What keeps you busy, especially during the winter months?
Well, the things that keep us busy is business. You know, we are full-time photographers, and as educators, we work with a number of photographers in the industry. So most photographers, landscape photographers, have a lone wolf approach where they will be doing photography on their own, doing workshops. We are slightly different. We have a website called Visual Wilderness, and we have a collaborative team approach. So we have almost 20 writers for us. We have a blog post that goes out every day, every other day, three times a week. We have video courses coming out every month. So everything keeps us busy, plus those damn teenagers. We have six of them.
Holy cow. Well, you know, my daughter is 2 years old right now, and she's a handful. I can only imagine as time goes on, that's not going to change, I don't think, right?
No, it's going to get exciting.
Oh, yes. That's one wonderful way to put it. Our life is a wonderful kind of chaos the last few years. And from everybody that I've talked to said, yep, just ride that roller coaster.
Yep. And enjoy the time. It actually is a really fun time. It goes fast.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, me being a photographic educator and photographer, I find that just trying to get enough time in my day to accomplish everything that I want to do. You mentioned you've got blog posts that go out every day or every other day, and you're constantly creating new content. For me, it's often a struggle between keeping myself passionate about what I want to do, to create something that is just maybe quirky and interesting, but doesn't necessarily have any monetary value. So for me, it keeps that passion flowing, and then realizing, hey, I got to keep the lights on. And I don't mind teaching people how to do all of this stuff as well. And then that turns into the whole education aspect of it. And it's fun because some of the stuff that I've been doing in the last year, you know, I've taken an image and it's got this kind of personal satisfaction of knowing that very few people have ever even attempted to do what I just did. The photo might be bad, but just the fact is that I'm kind of treading into some new territory and exploring it and keeping things fun and interesting. I mean, for me, that's really where the enjoyment of all of this is. And thankfully, you know, I don't take it for granted that I'm not a portrait photographer, and yet I can pay those bills with my photography. And I thank everybody that has been supporting, of course, this podcast and attending workshops and buying books and all of that other stuff there as well. So it keeps us all in business, and it's great to see how democratic the photographic industry has become in that regard in the last decade or so.
Totally agree. And then as a paradigm shift occurs in the photographic industry, where we're going from a medium of film to digital medium, there's a parallel paradigm shift occurring in how we consume photographs, how we consume educational content. You know, it used to be the big conferences were the ways to go, the big in-person conferences that we put. Nowadays, there's a lot of online education and learning and video things, and your content is now consumed by tablets and phones. I was just looking at my business stats, and 70% of our traffic is now on our website is through cell phones and tablets.
Only wow, that's a huge number.
Yes, and if I were to show you a graph to your viewers, in 2009, when we first launched the site, and if I look at the traffic over there, maybe about 5 or 10% of the traffic was mobile traffic. Today, 70% of my traffic is mobile traffic. And so the key to being a successful business person is to be able to figure out how to monetize than mobile traffic. It's not quite the same as being a desktop traffic.
Oh, no, absolutely. And you have to not only figure out how to create content that is better consumed on those mobile devices, you have to get people to that content easier and faster and intuitively. So, you know, understanding that perspective of things and from the business side of stuff, it's a lot of work. It's a lot to get your head around while you're dealing with six kids and creating content and everything else at the same time. Oh, wow. You are a bit of a superhero in that regard, and you have the utmost respect for me and many others to make it all happen.
I don't know about that.
Well, hey, I can say it. It's my opinion. And I'm at least entitled to that. But let's get into the topics that we have to discuss today, and kind of all over the map in terms of talking about gear and business. You know, it was a good segue actually into the business of photography, because a business has just failed. Image Brief, which they opened up a couple of years ago, offering a service where if you were a company and you needed a fairly specific image, something that you might not be able to find through the regular stock photo agencies, or that you wanted to add your own special twist on, you could ask Image Brief to list your requirements for you. And then photographers would come in and supply photographs that met those requirements specifically. Say if you were looking for a wind farm with a hilly landscape in Ontario, you know, we've got a lot of those, and there are others elsewhere in the world, but you might not be able to differentiate from one location to another. You might not find exactly what you're looking for. So then photographers could submit an image that met that exact requirement and then potentially get paid for it, because there would be a price tag associated with that upfront. Have you heard of this service before, Jay? Is this something
definitely. Yeah, I've heard about that. We actually, when we first started photography, I was in a full-time photographer. This was almost 10 years ago. And Raina was my wife. We both do photography work. And we participated in what we call today micro stock agencies, right? And at the time, the paradigm shift was going from stock agencies charging hundreds of dollars for an image to micro stock agency charging just pennies for your images, right? So the biggest problem when I first heard about Image Brief was maybe a few years ago, a friend of mine sent me saying, hey, check this out. It's a great service if you want to look at it. Is when that paradigm shift occurred from stock to micro stock agency, the revenues that the photographer was making is through the number of images that you upload, not through particularly quality or unique content perspective. Now, when you look at Image Brief, right, their business model was, hey, a specific image of a certain content. Now, if I was to go and create that image, I would expect that price tag to be fairly high, because it's my time they're being paid for. And I just did not see when I first heard about Image Brief that this is going to last very long, because it will run into a headlong competition with these micro stock agencies, which just sell the images for pennies, right?
Yeah, yeah. And when you look at the business model, they're kind of acting as a middleman, and there's really no place for that. If an agency wants to reach out to a specific photographer in a specific area and ask them to create an image because they know that it's, you know, you can Google them. You can Google a photographer that does the stuff that you are looking for, and you can ask them to make a custom image for you. And so from that perspective, I was a little bit on the fence. I did submit some images to Briefs, nothing that I went out and shot specifically, but stuff that I figured in my portfolio would be a pretty good match. And some of them were shortlisted, but I never actually got any money out of it. But I did see all of these briefs coming through, and some of them were so specific that the photographer would have to go out and shoot for it. But you're shooting images on spec at that point, right? Because you might be one of 10 or 100 photographers that are going to go out and try to make an image on that. And that is not a really good business model for a photographer to be embarking on. You're going to be doing a lot of work for free. But what was even worse is some cases that had just ridiculously high price tags that just kind of stood as an outlier. And they were asking for something much more conceptual, much more vague in nature. Like it needed to hit these ideas and have this feel, but they weren't actually being concrete about it. And I just had a sneaking suspicion that these people that were submitting these briefs on ImageBrief were doing so just to get ideas from people, not even with the intent to ever close a sale, but just to let other people do all of the creative legwork, come up with a cool concept, and then hire some other photographer for much less or a much lower rate. And so that was just always floating around in my head as something that was a bit fishy about it. And was it about a year or so ago, they started this preferred photographer system where you could pay them money as a photographer to be, and I'm not sure the specifics about what it was, but they were monetizing now the photographers and monetizing the sale. And that's when the writing was really on the wall for me about this particular service. That's not to say that I don't license my images. I do so regularly. And if I'm dealing with somebody to license a photograph, it's between a couple of hundred and a couple of thousand dollars that I might get for work that I've already created, or I might make something special for a customer. I've been working for documentary film companies for the last few years doing still and video work. It's fairly specialized in the macro field. And they come to me because I'm kind of the top of that game, right? I've been doing it fairly well for a number of years. And that reputation gets around. There's money to be made doing very specific things and delivering specific content for a specific purpose. But ImageBrief, they just disappeared. Like they didn't put out, they said, once the announcement was made that they were closing, you have 1 week to download any of your sales records and licensing records, and then it's all gone. We are just disappearing off the face of the planet. So this must have been happening for a long time behind the scenes, and to see it go this way just makes me feel like something wasn't managed properly in the back end either. I'm sorry to see them go, but yeah, it is the times.
I think when a company closes down this fast and this quickly, and personally, I think over the last few years, they were actually being funded by not their sales, but somebody else, like an investor or something. And when that dries up and the sales are not enough to fund your business, you have no money to continue the operation. You need to close it down as fast as possible. That is my take on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in terms of stock and licensing, Jay, do you ever license your images all?
Or? We regularly license the images. The way we do it is, every single image since last 12 years that I took that are landscape images are keyworded. Those keyworded images are then loaded into my gallery. And my gallery has a smart gallery feature so that those keywords, so all I do is I just dump everything in one gallery and I can say, okay, create a gallery for Montana, create a gallery for Canada, create a gallery for North America. So all those keywords will automatically create a gallery. So when a licensing person comes up, I say, oh, whatever you're looking for, just type that keyword in terms of terrain, locations, time of day, and all the images that I have will come up. And we regularly license our work.
That works really well. For me, as I don't want to call myself a lazy photographer, but I've never been diligent and focused enough to keyword things properly. The smart way around it for me is my cameras have GPS geotagging features, and a lot of software, Lightroom included, will add reverse geotagging information to your images. So if I was out in the Yukon wilderness shooting somewhere, well, that image will automatically be tagged with the word Yukon and Canada or wherever the location specific stuff is. And of course, they're time stamped as well. So all of that information is baked into the file to some degree. Sorting it out, I would have to specifically add a keyword for day or night because I don't think that there's software that would automatically detect the time and automatically add a day or night keyword, but that would be an interesting thing to do some research into. Organizing files and finding out where the audience is going to be for specific content has been a big challenge for me as well. Some of my images are listed on Science Source, which is a stock photo agency, and they've got some of my snowflakes and a few other things. Which one was licensed recently? from there for Bing. Bing has like a featured photo of the day in the background of their search engine. And I know that they got that from Science Source. And they don't have the same micro stock pricing. These are more timeless images, more very specific. And I'm not going to get a whole lot of licensing out of them. It's not a volume thing. But if I do get a specific sale from them, then Bing probably wouldn't have contacted me directly. They're the people that are going to only go to Getty or the larger stock agencies because they have a working relationship with them. And they probably have corporate accounts to collect their content. So there's many different facets to find your clientele here.
Yeah, we have several hundred images on our probably about 10 or 12 stock sites. And we find our images all over the place. We've seen our images in Seattle Airport, on streets in Bombay, India. We've seen our images in the hockey rink in California, all over the place.
So, well, and you know that you've licensed these images, and there's probably a legitimate license. But yes. You know, we talked about in the last episode that I had an image that I knew it had sold like 10 copies of, but I didn't know exactly where they were and where they ended up. And I was finding far more than 10 versions of it online. So I knew that a good chunk of them were infringing upon right. my image. So how do I differentiate? These were licensed through iStock Photo, and they refused to give me the list of the names of the people that licensed the images. So it was a really, really tough point to try and pin down who was legitimate and who wasn't. When I knew specifically that a good majority of them were not, and I should probably do something about that. Or you just kind of throw your hands in the air and say, yeah, that's just the way it's got to work, which I personally don't like at all. And I pulled all of my work from iStock Photo and the micro stock agencies at that time. And now people come to me and they ask me to license because I'm known in certain specialties like snowflakes or infrared or whatever it happens to be. And yeah, you know, if you get good at something, if you get the best at anything, people from around the world are going to come to you and ask for your talents to be put to use.
So we follow the same model. We never put our landscape photos for licensing anywhere other than our site, period.
Right.
So we know exactly who licensed our images, their landscape. Now, we will put up photos that we specifically shot for microstock agencies on that agency. So if I do see some photo of mine that I know that is on microstock agency, I would not be terribly surprised, and I would care less because the revenue from that image is minuscule.
Yeah. Well, and I did a test with one image. It was a cityscape of Toronto at night. And Toronto, the biggest city near me, we were on a rooftop, beautiful scene. But for the microstock agencies, I went in and I removed all of the corporate logos and wording and everything on the signs, and just to make it a clean, sellable image. And then I find people using the version with all of the words on it. I know for sure you did not license that one. And I can take you to task on that. But it's an interesting facet of our business, licensing and trying to, you know, keep control of where and when our images are used. And Image Brief was not long for this world, I don't think. Some people had some good sales, though. I heard some great stories. People hit the jackpot and made thousands of dollars on a license they wouldn't have otherwise found. But I don't think that was the most common the common occurrence there. So they are gone, never to come back. And who knows? I don't think anybody is going to kind of fill those same shoes again in the next little while once they kind of see what happened with Image Brief. But there's a lot of upstarts in the photographic industry now. One of them, a company, Erix, they've made some lenses in the last little while that caught a little bit of attention. The Erix Blackstone and Firefly 15mm, I think it was an f2.4 lens, which, you know, sounds on paper to be really interesting. And I would weigh that against some of the other Rokinon or Samyang wide angle, wide aperture lenses. But they've come out with an interesting item here. This is a neutral density filter, and it is a 15 stop neutral density filter designed specifically to use with their lens. So they're only selling it in a 95mm package, which is bigger than most people need. But when you're dealing with wide angle photography, especially landscape stuff, it is fun to have those clouds blurring in the sky to give a sense of drama and direction to an image. And this is definitely one way to do that, but it's a little bit suspect. You know, I'm looking at the company and, you know, the Eurex Edge ND 32,000, these numbers are getting out of control, for $200 US roughly. And it would take, if I did my math correctly, a 1/100th of a second exposure and give you about an 8 to 10 minute exposure as a result from that. Jay, in the kind of work that you do, have you ever needed to use an exposure 8 minutes long?
No. And we don't particularly care to go beyond 30 seconds. And I'll tell you why. It's not the exposure that actually makes the image. It is what you're shooting that makes the image, right? So sure, I can do, say, star trail images, 8 minutes long, it will appear great, but I can do the same star trail images by taking 30-second exposure and combining them in Photoshop.
Well, this is very true. Well, star trails, of course, you wouldn't be using an ND filter because you want to be collecting as much light as possible. Correct. But I understand the concept. And when I'm doing star trails, it's 30 seconds at a time. The camera has a wired remote that's plugged in. It's on continuous shooting. And I just lock in. The wired remotes have a button that can be depressed and locked down. So you just look at your watch and say, you know what? I'm going to come back in an hour. And you might not even use all of those images. You can collect far more than you need and decide on the final length of the exposure
Correct.
After the fact.
Correct.
If you're doing cloud blur and things like that, there's no reason why you can't take multiple, you know, 1 or 2 minute exposures or however long you want it to be. Maybe a little bit longer than the 30 seconds to ensure that there's no noticeable gap between the cloud movement. But you can just stack multiple exposures to appreciate that same level of motion. And there's very few reasons that I can think of in my head, aside from wanting to do it in some sort of elitist fashion that impresses only yourself, to do it as a single exposure.
But I think you should consider the other thing is landscape photography is all about creativity. And when you're out on location, you want to have as many options as possible, right? So if somebody were to tell me, hey, can I buy this filter? Should I buy this filter? I would say no. I would say buy 2 8-stop filters. Because with those 2 8-stop filters, you get the same effect. Plus, you have a choice of cutting down that exposure when you need to. So whenever we have a blog post on building filter kits, when we recommend filter kits to anyone, we would say that look at what you want to do and then purchase filters that will actually maximize your ability to use different filters in the field, stacked and unstacked. So that's how we approach how and what filters to buy.
I speak the same language. You know what? I've got a 10-stop neutral density filter and a 4-stop neutral density filter. I don't really find a need for something necessarily in between that range. The 4-stop gives me a lot of flexibility for video purposes specifically. And the 10-stop, if it ends up being a little bit too slow, I don't mind bumping my ISO up a little bit. You know, if I have to bring the ISO up a stop or two, the image is still going to be perfectly fine. And if the image does not survive the small amount of noise that is introduced in that process, it's probably a pretty crummy photograph to begin with. And I can stack the two of them together and I can go up to 14 if I really wanted to. So, you know, you've got those options there. The cost is also something interesting. And I thought, well, that might be, I'm used to expensive filters at that size, at 95 millimeter. But I took a look at a company that I've been a fan of their filters over the last few years, Breakthrough Photography, and really nice edging design, custom milled parts. And they have a 95 millimeter neutral density filter for almost the same price. It's like $20 more. And if you're going to go for, quality, I've owned their filters. I own their 10-stop, and they've got a 15-stop that is, you know, pretty comparable. So there are options out there if you're shopping around for a filter. You don't need the 15-stop. I'm not a fan of the variable neutral density filters either. You know, they tend to introduce a polarized effect, even if you don't want it. And if you go to the extremes, you'll get this sort of crosshatch kind of pattern that is really, really difficult to get rid of if you take an image that that encounters that. So yeah, just get a couple of static filters. But Jay, if you saw my filter pouch, you would just be like, why the hell would you ever need a hot mirror filter or an ultraviolet reflectance? Like they're called UV black filters and every spectrum of infrared filters and et cetera, et cetera. I've got far more filters than the average photographer would even know existed.
We do too. We are sponsored by Penro Filters. So any filters we want is just all we have to do is tell them we need it and it shows up. But it is, you have to consider the practical aspects of filters, right? You use filters to create images. Besides ISO bumping, you can also use aperture to control the light coming in and the shutter speeds coming in. And a little bit of aperture here and there isn't going to make that much difference in your landscape work. Not always, depends on how we shoot. So we carry filters based on how much we can carry on the plane and how much we can carry on our backs. Because when we're out on location, we have backpacks on our back all day long. And sometimes we'll hike 10 miles a day.
I've hiked up some mountains that have, you know, like 60 pounds of camera gear on my back during that that excursion. And I realized when I got to the top, you know, half of that I could have left at the bottom of that particular mountain, and I'm in the middle of nowhere. No one's going to take that with me. So yeah, weight and storage capacity is always a concern. But I think that a neutral density, a neutral density filter of any variety would be useful to a photographer, especially when you just want to have something like an extra tool to play with. And a 10-stop, I think, is more than enough for most people. But it is fun to see that these upstart companies are creating different options and creating competition in the marketplace, because us as photographers, I think, only benefit from that, so long as you know what to purchase and you don't buy one of everything.
True that.
Yeah. So if you're a new photographer, well, you might be listening to this podcast if you are geeky enough. But I found this kind of interesting from a perspective of where the heck does this fit in the marketplace today? Canon has announced their new 4000D, or in North America, it'll be called the Rebel T100. And this is the article that I have here from F-Stoppers calls it the race to the bottom, both in photographers' hearts and minds. And so you look at companies like Canon, and they're losing market share to the mirrorless market, and they're trying to make some waves to recover from that. Their point-and-shoot market has mostly dried up, and that was pretty big business for them in the last little while. So they have just introduced a new digital SLR that is the cheapest piece of plastic camera that you could manufacture, which will, they don't have North American prices, but it'll be about $385 US. Is that a good idea?
No. I have for long, we used to use Canon gear until probably about 2 years ago, and we loved it. Mm-hmm. What Canon has is phenomenal usability in their cameras. When you use Canon's cameras and you have it in your hand, what differentiates Canon cameras from pretty much all other brands is the camera is designed by photographers. All the functions that you need it are there. Now, they could have exactly taken that same design and put a mirrorless camera on there, right? There's no reason. They have the technology. They have their Canon M series cameras, and they were pretty good at times. They're stubbornly going the same way as Kodak did.
Ooh, those are fighting words.
Well, I'm sorry, but they're refusing to embrace the market of mirrorless cameras. That is, I don't know how else to put it. They have all the technology components in-house to produce a fantastic mirrorless cameras, but they are clinging to a DSLR. Now, the question that I have to ask is, why? And I don't see a good reason to answer that?
Well, there's two reasons that I have in my head right now. Number one is the newly released M50 will shoot 4K video. And so that's the first time on anything but the 1DC and the 1DX Mark II have they allowed 4K video to exist on any of their cameras. And they've given that privilege to a mirrorless camera. So there is some bend towards that. I think it might be a little too late because everybody else does that and has done it for a long time, but at least they're making some concessions there. But I've had an idea for a while based on patents that have been filed. Canon has a lot of patents that relate to curved sensor technology. And a curved sensor would require a different lens design fundamentally, a simpler and hopefully cheaper lens design, but a different mounting system, an entirely different platform to build up on. And so I think that if Canon were to be really serious about the mirrorless market, they would release a full frame mirrorless camera with a curved sensor and a new set of lenses that will start the industry trend in that particular direction, reinvent themselves that way. They've been getting the patents. They've been probably doing some research into this area, although I can't really confirm anything from the people that I've talked to. But it makes sense to me that they wouldn't just follow everybody else's footsteps because that's just the catch-up game. They would have to do something that would set them apart, make it an almost an apples and oranges comparison. And if they don't do that soon, then there's no point in even trying, I think. I'm a Canon shooter. I enjoy the Canon gear, but I've been using the Panasonic Micro Four Thirds cameras a lot lately, and they have just been hitting every checkbox that I have, aside from having a smaller sensor, but that hasn't really stopped the cameras from performing well.
So I think that when you look at our video courses, we create it with Sony and Canon. We can shoot with Nikon. We don't really care. But primarily, we're shooting with Canons and Sonys. Curved sensor is really good in practice. I mean, in theory. But what is it that it brings practically to non-photographers in general?
Oh, the big thing is cheaper lenses. For sure.
All right. So I actually guess that the big thing for them would be cheaper lenses. That is a lens design will simplify, and it simplify a lot by having a curved sensor. That is great. And if you can make combination of lens plus camera cheap enough to be able to use a curved sensor, more power to you, right? But on the other hand, if you look at the field of photography, just from a geeky perspective, is there are a lot of other variables that go into taking a photo other than just cheaper lenses and curved sensors, right? ISO performance, then there is how the lens and aperture work. Will the curved sensor, lens and aperture, and NDF depth of field work in the same way? I'm assuming they will. But all of those have to compete with the current technology. If they cannot compete with the current technology in the place that you're trying to compete against, it just defeats the purpose. Yeah. It's just a nice little, I mean, there are plenty of, in photography industry, there are plenty of examples that are similar to that. Fovion sensor, for example, was a phenomenal idea that you won't need an, it's super sharp, even at a low resolution, but they never really could make it work very well.
Well, their marketing was really disappointing because they would say, oh, well, it's a 40 mega ray sensor. Well, what does that even mean? That does not translate into megapixels or anything that I can, adapt my knowledge of image quality to comprehend. If you saw the images and compared them side by side, you'd say, hey, that looks really good. But I think the beauty of it was lost in the details and is only really coming back into, common knowledge now, where you've got the pixel shift technology, which mimics the Fovion quality quite well. Correct. For a static subject.
But I think we a long time ago, maybe about a few years ago, Sigma actually sent us a Fovion sensor camera and saying, here's a few $1,000 worth of gear. See what you can do. Evaluate us. Let us know how it works. We tried. It wasn't just the sharpness that the sensor had a problem with. The sensor had a problem with the depth of the sensor itself. So the way I believe that sensor was stacked was a blue pixel was on the top and the green pixel was in between and the red pixel was on the bottom. Well, the green and the red channels were so noisy. The red channel was very noisy because the light reaching the red channel wasn't quite enough. And the green channel light reaching was not enough so that it produced like a muddy green when we shot with the camera.
That's interesting.
So
yeah.
It isn't just that sharpness. Yeah, sharpness wise, it performed phenomenally well. Plus, Sigma's SD1 design was just junk. I mean, it was
like an art project in terms of the design
yes,
of that camera.
It was an art project. I mean, every time I took a photo, I had to wait like 30 to 40 seconds before I could take another one because the camera was busy writing to the card. I was like, guys, you cannot use this in the field. So we send the equipment back eventually.
But, you know, it's interesting that you have that perspective on it, which, of course, you wouldn't get with the pixel shift technology, again, for a static subject, a landscape. But I think that we're moving into not just more megapixels and higher ISO performance. We need the next step to be something that catches our attention. I've been shooting with the 1DX Mark II for a number of years. It's a 20 megapixel camera body. I don't think I need more than that for a lot of the work that I do. I mean, I'm making a business out of it as it is. But at the same time, do I need the next one? Unless it's a huge jump forward that really changes the way I look at photography, then I don't need another camera to replace that for at least a few more generations. And by that point, there won't be another camera that has a flapping mirror in the 1D series from Canon.
Yeah, but you're talking about you as a geek, right?
And of course.
But the $385 Canon camera is geared towards soccer moms and soccer dads. So,
I can't wait for somebody to put a heavy telephoto lens on this plastic lens mount.
Yeah, yeah.
And just have it break off. That only has to happen two or three times for this to be a huge reputation killer for Canon.
So, what I was going to say that if I can take that sensor performance of even an APC sensor and put it on my smartphone, I can sell 100 million of those. Or not even smartphone, even a point and shoot cameras can have, if you can get, so the technology of curved sensor and cheap lenses will compete with a sensor with a high ISO. Now, my take on this is if I am a parent, let's put my photography aside and let's look at me as a parent. If I'm a parent, the camera I want is to be able to capture my kids in any condition, right? And fit in my pocket. I'm not going to carry a mega DSLR. The only reason I'm carrying a mega DSLR is because that is the only thing available right now. If you can give me an RX10, like Sony camera, which performs really good. So if you can give me a sensor can take my kids' photos indoors and outdoors, right? This is what I want. So from a technology perspective, I think $385 market is geared towards the consumer level. And for those consumer level,
they're not even going to be looking at this camera. I think this camera is completely off their radar because for that price point, they'll be looking for a point and shoot. They'll be looking for a smaller, cheaper end mirrorless camera. And when they think digital SLR, they think higher price point. So yes, it does hit that lower price point. It's 3 frames per second. So it's not going to be useful for those soccer moms that want to capture the fast action.
And it's too big.
Well, but you know, at the same time, I did a quick eBay search for a used 5D Mark II, which was my first, a full frame camera. And absolutely, I loved it. And I still have it. I had it converted to infrared photography. It shoots high definition video really well. It's 3.9 frames per second. So it's a little bit faster there. And you'll get it for around $500 to $600 for a used full frame camera body. I mean, if you're looking for a way to start and you're savvy on what's on the market, there are so many better options for you to go and look at. You mentioned the RX10, the RX100 is another great pocket camera. This camera will find no audience. And it's sad to see that Canon research and development has gone into making this a viable product for, or sorry, they hope to be a viable product that will be sitting on store shelves and you will never see a successor to it. It's going to be one of those things that just disappears.
That's the thing that I don't quite understand with the Canon is even their Canon 6D Mark II. What's with the DX? What's with the dynamic range? Right, the dynamic range. Canon has the technology to. They could have put the dynamic range and 4K video in that camera, and they would have had a killer camera in the price range. But for whatever reason, their marketing decided that's not the way to do it.
And you look at Sony just eating their lunch with the A9, really covering a lot of ground into the pro market. The A9 Mark II, whatever camera that will be seriously, it'll have Canon and Nikon pro level bodies in their crosshairs. And so that market has always been small and will always be small. The biggest part of the market is the prosumer market, where you can make a camera that has technology that is paid for by the bigger guns into a smaller package. Yeah, cut a few corners here and there. Oftentimes, it's only done in software where you'll remove a feature or two and charge less for it for the masses. And Canon is failing at doing that appropriately. You know, when I'm using these smaller Lumix cameras, they've got a built-in intervalometer.
Right.
You know, that's a wonderfully useful feature. And I've used that. I used the GH5 to shoot some footage for a National Geographic documentary that will be out later this year. If I wanted to do that on my Canon camera, well, I would have to have their own proprietary intervalometer. There are knockoffs that cost like $20, but the Canon version of that, they still want to charge you a premium of like $150 for this little gadget that you can get for pennies on the dollar, quite literally, from other people. They just haven't adapted to the changing market. And I'm still a Canon shooter. I love my Canon camera bodies, but the writing is on the wall here. And I've said that about a few things in this conversation because the industry is changing. The paradigms are shifting quite drastically from the traditional model of photography and manufacturing and licensing into some new creature that we're seeing kind of be born from the ashes of what photography was 20 years ago.
Yeah, it'll be a fun ride for the next 5 years.
It will be. Now, one of the things that Canon had introduced when they first brought about their EF and their EOS technology is they decided to stick it to Nikon and produce a 50mm f1.0 autofocus lens for their camera bodies. And it wasn't perfect. It had a lot of issues, especially when it came to bokeh, where the autofocus details would have this weird kind of cutoff shape. And the same was true of the f1.2 lenses, because some of the light was getting, it was hitting against the lens mount where the electrical contacts were, and in the mirror box inside the camera itself, and it was kind of making the bokeh look less spherical and beautiful as a result. And so, you know, if you were to compare that to a Leica f0.95 lens, then there'd be no mirror box getting in the way. It would be a simpler manual design, and that's where some of the quality concern for the Canon versus another brand might come in. Caveat, by the way, Nikon could never produce a lens like that, and Canon knew it. As soon as autofocus came in, the Nikon lens mount can only support up to f1.4. And if you were to go f1.2, you would have to remove the autofocus and the electrical contacts on the lens in order to achieve that. So Canon was, they knew that Nikon couldn't even make a comparable product. And they were just saying, hey, look what we have. It's going to cost you way more than it needs to, and nobody's going to buy it, but we are the king of the castle here. Well, in the new age of photography, there have been a lot of upstart lens manufacturers. We were talking about Irix earlier, Irix, however it's pronounced. Zhongyi Optics, if I butchered that one, I'm not sure, has produced a number of lenses, including their Metacon series of lenses. And they've got their Speedmaster 50mm f0.95 lens, which normally is only available in a Sony mount, at least it is today. But at CP Plus, the conference that just wrapped up recently, they were showing off a version on the Canon EF lens mount. And I got to ask, I mean, you're a landscape photographer, not necessarily a portrait photographer, but f0.95, I mean, that's a luxury number. I mean, there's not a whole lot of difference in terms of the amount of light collected, especially with CMOS sensor technology that doesn't gather a lot of light from extreme incident angles. But is this a useful product for you? Or for, if you could imagine it, a useful product for any photographer?
I would say from a photography perspective, its uses are limited. You give me 1.2 lens or 0.95 lens, I would say, yeah, it's not that bad. I mean, it's not that different, right? So I can usually get Canon's 1.2, take it in the field, or even 1.4, because we normally almost never shoot at that aperture for landscape photography. We do. There are creative photos that I've taken, which will take me down to f2.8 to shoot. Now, one can say, oh, you can do night photography with this, right? But with night photography, you need a wider lens.
Well, and I tried to use the Canon 50mm f1.2 lens to do some night photography focusing on the stars. And there's a big issue with some of these really good lenses called coma distortion. And around the edges of the frame, you have these like bat wing looking stars where right. the singular light point of the star is spread out into this winged shape.
Right.
And it, you know, a very expensive multi-$1,000 lens fails miserably at that particular subject. Whereas a much cheaper lens, like those manual Rokinon 14mm lenses, they actually perform really, really well for astrophotography at night. I did find one exception to that rule there. If I try to put the stars out of focus, to focus on something in the foreground and have the stars turn into background bokeh, at f1.2, that actually becomes really beautiful. And so if you can create a composition where you are intentionally making the stars big blobs in the sky for artistic effect, well, that's a bit of a one-trick pony. You do it once, you move on, and you don't want to spend the money on this sort of lens to do that.
No, if I were to actually need something like that, this is such a specialty lens, I would actually rent it. I am more likely to rent lenses like this. Even we don't own actually lenses that go to f2.0 even, and other than 50mm. The reason we use 50mm f2.0 lens is to do video work. Now, that is what I was trying to say is, from a photography perspective, it is a limited use. Now, if you're doing video work where you want super blur background and your sharpness doesn't quite matter that much, especially because your subject is going to be in the center or in the safe zones, then the lens will become an interesting something interesting to have.
Yeah. Well, and I've used, again, 1.2 at the 50mm and 85mm range. I tried autofocus and it failed miserably, even on a very high-end camera body, because you focus on the nose and the eyes are out of focus. Or you know, if the person you're photographing isn't perfectly square to the camera,
right.
One eye will be out of focus and the other eye is going to be in focus. It becomes a very difficult depth of field to play with when you're shooting wide open like this. And I can only imagine it's more of a challenge at f0.95. So being a manual lens, I don't think hurts this at all. But you have to be very specific about what subject you are going to be shooting. And the thing is, though, that this is not a Leica Noctilux f0.95 that has a $12,000 price tag.
Right.
This is selling for $700 or $800.
Correct.
And so at that price point, to renting it might be useful. And I've rented these portrait lenses. I don't own them. You know, that I get sort of a test drive from Canon Professional Services. And so they'll loan one to me for a couple of days for me to try out. And you know, I'll have it handy for when I need it. But the price point of those lenses is so high that I would never buy one for the kind of work that I do. But if I'm sub $1,000 and I could find a use to say, you know what, 3 or 4 times a year, this kind of lens might be useful for me to have, or when I'm out in the field and I'm doing star trails and my main camera is set up doing that, I've got an hour to waste, I've got a backup camera body, well, I'm just going to tinker around with whatever else is in my camera bag. And this kind of a lens could come up with some creative opportunities for you. Are there cheaper ways to get that? Absolutely. You don't need f0.95. You flat out don't need it. And if that wide of an aperture gives you some funky bokeh that is just misbehaving because of the way the light interacts from the point of the end of the rear element to the sensor, then it's not going to be helping you in any meaningful way either. So yeah, it's out there. It's hopefully going to be available in a Canon mount and maybe more mounts in the future. But again, special need lenses are very hard to find creative uses for. But hey, that's the industry that we live in here. And the Kickstarter campaigns for new lenses come up every week, flooding my inbox. And I am shocked as to how much money gets spent on these lenses that are archaic optical technology from the 1950s and 60s often.
Well, you know, photography is a hobby and an expensive hobby as well. So people have money to spend, and I'm sure people will find ways to spend it.
Exactly. So let's get into the picks of the week section of the podcast, where I'm going to make somebody maybe spend a bit of money, just a tiny bit of money here on my pick. And I understand yours is probably less than mine. Yes. I do a lot of tabletop macro photography stuff in my studio. And that requires me to have lights, whether it be flashes or very bright flashlights, very close to the subject and in a controlled and orderly fashion. In a previous episode, I recommended a third hand tool as a great little piece of kit to do, you know, position things and carefully orientate your subjects in different ways. But Manfrotto and other manufacturers make them, but I've got a number of these Manfrotto Pixie tabletop tripods. And these are fantastic at a very cheap price, between $20 and $30. You don't need the more fancy ones, just the basic ones will do. Tripod mount on a table with a ball head. It'll support a flash. It'll support a small camera. It'll even support flashlights, because you can get these little clamps that Manfrotto makes one called the Nano Clamp, but there are third-party stuff you can get for 10 or 15 bucks on eBay from Hong Kong. And it has a little tiny clamp that lets you just go around the barrel of a small flashlight and use that as a positionable light source for macro photography. When I teach workshops and somebody doesn't have the necessary flash or lighting equipment, they get one of these mounted with an ultra-bright LED flashlight that will work wonders for close-up macro work when we're doing water droplet refractions and stuff like that. So these little Manfrotto Pixie tripods, that is my pick of the week. And I should also tag on that I do have some of those workshops coming up. And so if you are curious to learn how to do those wonderful, magical, putting in a flower inside of a water droplet, they are on my website at doncom.ca. And there's about 5 dates coming up for the 2018 year. So great tools to have, and doesn't break the bank compared to the, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars that a new lens that you're lusting after is going to cost you.
So my pick of the week is, since your viewers don't really know who we are, or some of them may, or what we do, we're going to send you guys to Visual Wilderness to look at our complete landscape photography guide. It's completely free of charge. It is online, and you can view it on anything that you want. You can view it on your phone, you can view it on your tablet, you can view it on your computer. And essentially, it actually lists the skills you will need to be a fantastic landscape photographer. And it goes all the way from basic skill set to all the way to being in business. And you can check it out. There are learning tracks available in there as well. So if you're learning, if you're looking to learn something specific, say how to do how to master focus, then there's a focus learning track. And we are always adding to that. So go check it out. Read all you want. And if you want to purchase something, go ahead and click on the shop button and you'll be able to go into our offerings. We offer about 25 or 30 different landscape photography courses that includes complete end-to-end look at how you create an image in the field, to how you process the image and come up with final results.
And that is at visualwilderness.com. And we'll put the link to the exact beginner's guide that you were mentioning there in the show notes for people to kind of dip their feet in the water and see what you're all about there. Now, how many hours of content do you have?
I don't know. Probably, I would say over 100 hours or so.
Oh, wow. So there's a lot of learning experiences to be had.
There's 30 video courses. Each video course is about 2 hours on average length, or 3 hours in average length, depends on what you purchase.
And I find that to be kind of the saturation point for a lot of people. You know, if you're sitting either in a workshop in person or absorbing content, 2 hours is about, after that, it's kind of going in one ear and out the other, or in one eye and out the other. I'm not sure if that analogy works quite the same way. But if you can, kind of piece that out into smaller chunks and kind of take one lesson at a time, when I'm teaching a workshop, the reason why my water droplet workshops are limited to 3 hours is because you get an onslaught of knowledge, and you have to, while you're there in person, put all of that to both practical use and commit it to long-term memory. Where the video tutorial aspect, I mean, it's you're not hands-on with people, pointing out exactly what their mistake is going to be, but they can rewatch it and they can figure that out as part of the learning process. And the majority of learning for photography, I mean, I taught myself using online tutorials and videos and things like that. And I've, invented certain techniques over the years, and I've shared those with other people. But the traditional learning model of photography, of like going to school for it, getting a diploma or degree in photography, you don't need that anymore. And I hate to see people that are spending a lot of good money to be a good photographer at a college or a university when, Jay, what is your educational background?
I have three master's degrees.
Three and master's none of, degrees. And none are of them any are of them in photography? No.
No. I have actually in-depth knowledge about how to do semiconductors. So I have a master's degree in electrical engineering and applied physics. And I have a couple of MBAs, one in marketing and one in technology management. So nothing to do with photography. And here I am, full-time photographer with my wife. And I do want to mention something about the learning aspects that you were saying is our most popular service. We know from a fact, and we monitor traffic on our site and where the traffic comes from, is one of the best ways to learn photography is to watch videos, online videos. Our most popular offering is a streaming service. We offer all these content that we create that is available today and is going to be available tomorrow and day after. You can stream it. And we offer a $14.95 to $19.95 streaming service. And most people, rather than purchasing video courses and downloading almost 50 to 100 gigabytes of video files and trying to keep and back up, they will just purchase a streaming service. That way, you can be anywhere, on your couch, on your any of your computers, and watch it.
You are the Netflix of photography.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. Well, Jay, as we sign off for this again, all that content is at visualwilderness.com, and people can find you there. And I'm sure you're active on the various social media platforms as well for interacting and finding out, asking specific questions or seeing what the latest and greatest that you are up to. You go on a lot of different adventures and travel quite a bit. So what's the next adventure that you're going to be on?
We are going to Machu Picchu in about 6 weeks. And after that, we'll be in Hawaii in the summer. And after that, we'll be doing a conference at Out of Moab from Out of Chicago Conference Center. And I'm sure in between, we'll find some ways to go to Faroe Islands or Iceland or New Zealand or some other place.
I'm envious. You know, as a macro photographer, I can make amazing images in my backyard. And then I realize, I got to mow the lawn. I got to trim the trees. I got to make sure that everything
is... We got to do all that too.
Well, yeah, true enough. Although we've got like a mini orchard and botanical garden thing going on. So it requires a fair amount of attention. And we're coming up to spring. So that's going to be keeping me really busy. Planting some new trees and some more exotic flowers. I was doing some work recently with ultraviolet fluorescence, and it's a magical area of photography that few people have explored. And somebody had posted an image of a South African succulent. What was it? The Masonia species, the variety of different species within that classification. And they were just absolutely stunning in ultraviolet fluorescence. So I asked myself, how do I get these? And so talking to a bunch of different people, I finally found a guy that can sell me the bulbs for this. But the process to bring them into Canada, you've got to get all of these weird certifications and it costs a whole lot of money. And then I'll be growing South African succulents in my studio to take a picture of that flower glowing under ultraviolet light. the kind of things that I do just to get a picture. It might be just easier to fly to South Africa, to be honest.
And more exciting.
Probably. So maybe I should do that instead. All the time for adventures in the future, I'm sure. We're winding down this episode. So, Jay, I want to thank you again for being on as my guest. And you're welcome back anytime. I think that it was a great discussion. I value your opinions on all of the stuff that we talked about. And for anybody listening, well, you've listened long enough. Now it's time to get out and shoot.